November 25, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. The producer for the evening news is Josh Salem, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Edwin J. Vieira, Mel Gertov, Antonia Gonzalez, Catherine Carley, and Laura Hatch. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth.
When I'm feeling a little bit low, I listen to my radio, 90.7 on the FM dial. It's always sure to make me smile. KBOO, boo! This is Michelle Shock saying howdy.
Check out Ear to the Streets of Portland with hosts Sequoina
and Kayla
every first and third Thursday of the month starting at 7 o'clock p.m.
Listen in as we interview community organizers, speak on issues focused on Black Portland, and share community events happening in the area and elsewhere.
Listen on the radio at 90.7 FM, online at www.kboo.fm, or from your mobile phone at m.kboo.fm.
Follow KBOO on Instagram at KBOO Radio. Ear to the Streets.
You're listening to Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. Should we be logging our drinking watersheds to protect them? That's the question for residents of Walla Walla, Washington, whose pristine drinking water comes off national forest land. The Forest Service is planning a major and multifaceted project with the stated purpose of protecting Walla Walla's drinking water from wildfire. But what about the impacts of road building and commercial logging in intact native forest? What's that going to do to the watershed? These questions over how and whether to use so-called active management to mitigate fire risk grow more relevant every year, and there's a growing body of evidence that in many cases, the Forest Service is not coming up with the right answers. My guest today is Paul Lynn, a Walla Walla-based mycology business owner turned community organizer. Paul has been creatively working to bring his community together to oppose commercial logging within the Walla Walla watershed, and I am delighted to talk with him. My email is coastrangeradio@gmail.com. Please reach out and let me know what you think of the show. Paul Lynn, welcome to Coast Range Radio.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this conversation. So for folks like myself that aren't super familiar with Walla Walla in eastern Washington, just tell me a little bit about what's special about your community and the ecosystems around it.
Gladly. Walla Walla is kind of a hidden gem in southeastern Washington. I think when most people think about eastern Washington and Oregon, they think about sagebrush desert and big open landscapes. But Walla Walla is a really fertile valley that's nestled up against the Blue Mountains. There's a little bit of the Blue Mountains of eastern Oregon that actually stretch up into southeastern Washington here. And so the combination of our location in the kind of the base of the Missoula floodplain, we have an incredible amount of rich topsoil. And then we also have a really abundant deep well aquifer. So agriculture is really important here, which has led to a burgeoning tourism industry. But what I love most about this region is the Blue Mountains themselves. It's a really, really unique ecology that we have. They're not big, craggy, rocky peaks like the Rockies, but the Blue Mountains have a humble elegance to them that I think lends itself to the kind of ecological curiosity that brings people like me here.
I love that description, and I do love the Blue Mountains. And of course, I spoke recently with Paula Hood, co-director of Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project, and that's how actually we got connected. So how did you, just to sidetrack for a real quick second, how did you all get linked up?
I first met the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project. Someone was tabling at the Radical Mycology Convergence a few years ago, back in 2018. And I am a mycologist by trade, and was just excited to meet someone who is doing environmental advocacy work and that kind of thing here in my region. Attended a couple of fundraising events and just kind of got connected, ended up doing some work on a previous timber sale as well, and just really love what that organization has been doing, and I'm looking forward to working with them more and helping to support their work, sort of boots on the ground out here in Washington.
Well, great. Well, let's maybe use that as a segue to one of the main things we're talking about. And I do actually want to get into your mycology work later if we have time. But let's start with the work that you've been doing around a particular timber sale in the Walla Walla watershed. So could you give an overview of the Tiger Mill timber sale? You know, what's being proposed, why you oppose it, and where things stand now?
Certainly. So the Tiger Mill timber sale, like many such timber sales in national forest land, is kind of a broad project that involves a number of different parts. So when the project is formed, they're kind of lumping a few different things together and then conducting a single NEPA process, in this case, an environmental analysis. So central to the project is what they call non-commercial thinning and prescribed fire within the Mill Creek Municipal Watershed, which is a very heavily protected tract of old growth forest that serves as the primary source of my community's water supply. Walla Walla, the city of Walla Walla draws about 90% of its municipal water from the Mill Creek watershed directly. We don't have water filtration, and for over 100 years have enjoyed pristine drinking water coming straight off the mountain. Since about the early 2000s, there's been kind of a growing concern, and an idea was planted in someone's mind that there is a growing risk of high severity fire within the watershed itself. And so the proposed actions within the Tiger Mill project are, on the one hand, to offer a solution to mitigate this perceived risk of high severity fire. So that's where they're going to be cutting hand lines and kind of creating more defensible perimeters to then conduct about 20,000 acres of prescribed fires within the municipal watershed itself. You know, there's a lot that can be said there about that, but then to just sort of zoom out a little bit.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the Mill Creek Municipal Watershed is kind of the centerpiece. It's about two-thirds of the project area, which is around 38,000 acres. The project area, so there's the Mill Creek Municipal Watershed, and then slightly larger than that, about 4 or 5,000 acres additional to the municipal watershed, is the Mill Creek Inventoried Roadless Area, which is a really special tract of de facto wilderness that is adjacent, separated by one high road from the Winnaha-Tukanen Wilderness Area, which is one of the most sort of undisturbed parts of the Blue Mountains. Really, really special places. So there's the Mill Creek Municipal Watershed, the Inventoried Roadless Area, which is slightly larger, and then there's also a considerable amount of old growth and never logged forests within the project plan that extend to the south in the adjacent watersheds. And so within the kind of the stretches of the Inventoried Roadless Area outside of the protected municipal watershed, and then in the adjacent watersheds, there's 6,622 acres of commercial logging proposed. So
within,
for someone,
I'm sorry, just real quick, within the Inventoried Roadless Area?
There is a significant amount of commercial logging within the Inventoried Roadless Area, yes.
Of course. I want to dig into some of these details with you a little more, because I'm finding this really interesting. But Just real quick, where do things stand now? And then I want to circle back to some of the specific parts.
Well, so I first learned about this project from Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project, who contacted me in April. Okay. The final project decision was actually signed back in February. And this, like a number of other recent timber sales, was kind of fast-tracked through the environmental assessment process. So typically there would be a draft EA that would be circulated for public comment, and that was not done in this case. There were scoping comments back in 2023, and then they went ahead and signed the final decision. So there was a finding of no significant impact, a final decision, and now the project is formally closed. But there are opportunities for modification, and those of us who oppose this plan are still hopeful that there actually is an opportunity to completely halt the process and hopefully get a little bit more consideration of some of the greatest risks that we believe were inadequately addressed.
Okay. Well, I'm going to ask you a couple times throughout here how people can learn more and get involved, and this is going to be the first time. So how do people contact you, or should they contact Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project? How do people learn more and get involved?
Well, I can't speak highly enough of Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project and the work that they're doing. There are a lot of great opportunities to get involved there. And, you know, they're also really just deeply connected with a lot of other organizations in this field. And they're one of the few organizations that's working out here on the east side in our very special east side forests. As far as the Tiger Mill project itself, I created kind of a landing page to help guide and coordinate some of the community organizing I'm doing, and that is wallawallawatershed.com.
Great. Let's circle back into some of the details. One thing you mentioned that stands out to me is how often these projects will have things that are, from a lot of people's perspectives, really helpful for, you know, the ecosystem of the forest, mixed with things that are negative. And, you know, there's the whole like, well, we have to log some of the trees to pay for protecting the rest of the trees, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm just curious where you come down on some of the different aspects of the project. You know, you talked about non-commercial thinning and burning, and that is, you know, something that a lot of conservationists support, some don't. So from your perspective of someone who lives out there and obviously has spent a lot of time thinking about this, where do you stand on the various parts? Are there any things that you think would be beneficial? Because, you know, obviously I can guess where you stand on the commercial logging part.
Yeah. You know, I think it's important for me to differentiate between my personal views and then what I think I can speak to in terms of representing my community. In the course of this process, I think I have kind of been unofficially nominated as a bit of the kind of the community voice on this topic. Part of that just owing to the fact that I've buried myself in project documents and a lot of the scientific literature. As for kind of the general overarching idea that, you know, there's an increase in the severity of wildfire and we need to be able to mitigate that through these kind of wildfire prevention or you know, fuels reduction projects, that it's a complicated conversation. Mm-hmm. And I think that conversation needs to be deeply rooted within the particular ecologies of the places in question. So when you're painting with a broad brush, even just saying the Blue Mountains in general, and one thing that I would have loved to mention earlier is just how special the Blue Mountains are in one very unique characteristic, which is that unlike most of the other forests sort of east of the Cascade Crest, the Blue Mountains actually have high elevation moist alpine forests, mixed conifer moist forests, as well as kind of the more dry land, you know, open stand ponderosa pine forests that I think are kind of what people think of when they think about this region.
Right.
And in many cases, those two forest ecotypes are actually located immediately adjacent to each other, such that from one slope to the next, you'll have two totally different forest types, and they create almost like tiger stripe patterns throughout the landscape called the grass tree mosaic, which incidentally, I think in this case it's important to think about, because when we're talking about, you know, landscape prescribed fire, non-commercial thinning, ecological thinning, these kinds of things, we're talking about an enormous amount of work And it's they're laborious processes, and so we need to be strategic about them. They're also costly. I mean, you know, like you said, there's always going to be some kind of economic requirement to any of those plans. So in terms of being strategic about where and when to apply things like prescribed fire, obviously defensible space around homes and that kind of a thing makes a lot of sense. When we're talking about something like the moist mixed conifer forest in the Mill Creek Municipal Watershed, where Walla Walla's drinking water comes from, a lot of the experts in this would say that that is the forest type at the lowest priority for prescribed fire as a fuels reduction strategy. So I do think that the actual kind of, at least ostensibly beneficial parts of the project are deeply problematic, if not just kind of dangerous, but obviously that also has to be taken into account within the context of the larger project itself and the larger landscape of the funding of such things. And
yeah, so the, you know, when I've had these conversations with folks and I've talked with a lot of people about fire management policy on this show, I can't claim to be anything close to an expert on it, but this is an interesting case because usually we're talking about logging in the backcountry versus protecting homes and communities. And I think that's, you know, it's pretty clear that logging to protect from wildfire in the backcountry is an absolute waste of money as opposed to home hardening and that defensible space right around a community, like you're saying. One of the reasons that I'm interested in this is that you're talking about a municipal watershed. And so you're not really talking about backcountry logging or, you know, adjacent to homes as much. And so I guess I'm wondering, is there an argument, whether you buy it or not, you know, is the argument that either the city of Walla Walla or the Forest Service or both of them are making that this will protect the integrity of the watershed? Is that kind of what they're saying there? And what do you, if so, what do you think about that argument?
That is definitely the argument. And I think the other major kind of talking point for proponents of the plan is that it's about making it easier for wildfire crews to get in and to manage fires that do occur within the watershed, and namely those that are ignited by the Forest Service staff themselves. And so, you know, it's kind of, I think a lot of it being sold as, This is about protecting lives. This is about protecting access to the landscape for firefighting crews. I would say, in terms of, like, you know, will that actually work to reduce the risk of wildfire? I think that the answer is no, frankly, and I think that there's actually quite a bit of literature that could support that perspective. The overarching sentiment, I would say, on behalf of city staff and the agency, the Forest Service themselves, is we have to do something. There's this kind of through line in all of the project documents and all of the publicity around this that, you know, if we don't do something, the whole thing is going to burn. It's going to be catastrophic. We'll have crown fires. It'll level everything and it'll be a huge disaster for our community. So we have to do something. And then within that, you know, in proposing something to do, there is this kind of explicit acknowledgement of the fact that there are a lot of untested theories, that there's a lot of contention within the scientific community about the efficacy of these ideas, and just in general that, you know, there's uncertainty. So that uncertainty is being balanced against the sort of certitude of this supposed catastrophic fire that we're going to see if we don't do something. And one of the points that I've been really trying to harp on in all of this is that we need science to back that up. I mean, if we're going to be basing an enormous amount of work and taking on a huge amount of risk to prevent this wildfire, we need to balance that risk against the actual quantified risk of the fire itself, which in all of my research, there is nothing to back up the claim that there will be a high severity catastrophic fire within the watershed within the 20-year time frame that the fuel treatments are supposedly effective. So a lot of uncertainty and a lot of unanswered questions there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, just my personal view of the Forest Service is even if you want to hold them in the most generous light, there's just that always that like bias towards action, sort of clouding their judgment there. And you know, hey, what's ever gone wrong with that, right? So actually, I'm so sorry to keep going on down the rabbit hole on this. One last question on this, and then I want to ask what you've been doing to oppose the sale. I want to ask about the Confluence series you started. But so last question on kind of the nitty-gritty of this. What is the, because I don't know the ecology and the indigenous history of that area, what's the history or lack of history that you're aware of about, you know, indigenous fire practices in that area? Because obviously that kind of enters the conversation anytime we're talking about fire.
Yeah. Again, it's complex. I would say that one of the particularities of the Tiger Mill sale is that it's extremely steep landscape. Most of the slopes in question are between 35 and 50% slopes, which is very steep.
Yeah.
And then the majority of these areas are the grass tree mosaic. So they're, you know, open stand ponderosa pine with moist mixed conifer forest on the north slopes, sort of call it like south slope and north slope type forests. And in a way, when you look at the landscape, you can kind of see how those south face or the south slope type forests create natural fire breaks in the landscape. And also I think are very kind of typical of the open stand ponderosa pine forests that we know were really heavily managed by the indigenous people, with low intensity and frequent fires on an interval of, you know, usually like about 12 to 15 years is my understanding. That said, many of those sort of open stand ponderosa forests haven't seen any of those frequent low intensity fires in the last 150 years and have remained very stable, relatively speaking, regardless of that fact. So I think that there's certainly a case to be made that the kind of land tending practices that have been really important in shaping the ecology of the Blue Mountains region in particular are very much to be seen and to be understood as part of the history of this particular part of the landscape. But I also think that the kind of the idea that fire has been excluded and that that has changed the landscape so much doesn't really quite map onto the area in question the way that it does some of the more arid or, you know, some of the lower elevation forests in the Blue Mountains.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. Well, thanks for that. And of course, the cynical read on some of this is that the timber industry and the Forest Service themselves, parts of it maybe, you know, want to shift the conversation to fire exclusion from, you know, wholesale liquidation of primary forests as the, you know, as the cause of supposed increase in high intensity fires. And that's the subject of a different conversation mostly, but food for thought. So one more time before we move on to the Confluence series, or maybe this segues into that, what have you been doing to oppose this sale? And again, how can listeners, you know, learn more and get involved?
Gosh, Michael, I feel like there's one thing I want to just kind of earmark before we move on.
Yeah.
Obviously, as you said, it is perhaps a conversation for another time, but I do think it's just really important to highlight in the context of the Tiger Mill sale how, you know, I think we're all, most of your listeners, I would imagine, are kind of familiar with some of the wildfire messaging and how that's related to the ambiguities about thinning. You know, ecological thinning versus commercial timber harvest sold under the guise of ecological thinning, and understanding that there's a pretty big difference there. But I think it, in the context of Tiger Mill, it is important to acknowledge that a big part of the impetus for this sale is that many of the timber units in question are actually old growth, never logged forests, where the majority of trees are above 21 inches and they're on steep slopes with fairly loose ashy soils, which have made them kind of a pretty untouchable forest as far as, you know, the timber speculation goes. With relatively new cable assist logging and some of these other things, it's now possible to log those areas, but there's still some question as to whether or not that's a good idea.
Yeah.
The biggest thing for me in this that I do want to highlight before we move on is that there's sort of a growing consensus, I would say, and also just I think an intuitive understanding that intact forest ecosystems are really, really integral for climate, for a whole host of other things, including biodiversity and many other human uses. You can call them ecosystem services, and that intact forests have value beyond just the board feet of their timber.
Right.
However, these particular forests in question, because they're sort of untouchable, I think they've been a high priority for targeting for timber extraction, but there hasn't been really a foot in the door. The thing here is we have a provision within the Blue Mountains Forest Plan called the East Side Screens, which forbids the commercial harvest of trees in excess of 21 inches at breast height, which is, you know, large trees, although relatively speaking, that's not huge, and most trees are actually above that size. So it's restricted access to units like this because most of the trees are above that size. In this context, the idea is that if we don't log the large old growth, never logged trees, those provide more fuel for fires because they store more carbon, therefore more carbon equals more fuel, therefore more fuel equals more intense fires. And so part of the Tiger Mill project has just completely bypassed the East Side Screens altogether, and they are planning to log trees of any diameter.
Right. I mean, yeah, no matter what the merits of things like non-commercial thinning, burning, et cetera, might be. I mean, just the idea of logging primary intact forest is, I don't have radio-friendly words for that. It's kind of insane. So I'm really glad to hear that you're working on this issue. I hope that listeners will, especially anybody listening, you know, on the East Side or with connections to the East Side, will reach out and get involved. So for now, is there anything we've missed or anything else you want to get included in this conversation?
Thanks, Michael. I really appreciate your perspective and your questions. I think the thing for me in all of this is just feeling how, regardless of where you're coming from or where you're going, we all need water, and our planet is drying up. And that's, you know, I think obviously kind of just indicating a larger conversation, but the water table here is dropping. I know it's happening in a lot of places, and I just really hope to see a more holistic approach to things like agriculture and forest management, and understanding the absolutely integral role that forests play in anchoring terrestrial hydrology. If we don't have forests, we don't have water. They create cloud systems, they regulate climate, and we're really only beginning to understand some of the vast implications of human land use over the last 200 years, and also just only beginning to understand some of the intricacies of what I call hydroecology. And so I'm just hoping that that can become a bigger conversation, that more and more people can begin to talk about, you know, yeah, we talk a lot about fire, but let's talk about water.
Absolutely. Well, that's a great note to end on. So final plugs, that just one more time, where can people go to learn more about any of the things that we've talked about today?
Yeah, thank you. If you're interested in getting involved or just following along with the work that I'm trying to organize around the Tiger Mill sale and other potential kind of activism within the Blue Mountains region, go to wallawallawatershed.com, and that's where all you can sign up for email updates and kind of action alerts. And then would be thrilled if anyone and everyone who's interested in free education as a form of activism to go check out the confluenceseries.org and sign up on any of the platforms you normally use. There's not much there yet, but we've got a lot in the pipeline. Got another really cool event coming up next week, and about 24 scheduled already for next year that I'll be putting a program together for pretty soon here. And then, yeah, if you're interested in learning more about fungi and what I do with Fungaia, that's fungaia.life.
Well, Paul Lynn, it has been a delight talking with you today. Thank you so much for the work that you do, and thank you for joining me on Coast Range Radio.
Thanks, Michael. Truly a pleasure. Really grateful for the opportunity.
That's all we have time for today on Coast Range Radio. We are an independent, volunteer-run show. You can find us by searching for Coast Range Radio on any podcast app. We're free and ad-free. And you can follow us on Instagram if you're into that kind of thing. The show email is coastrangeradio@gmail.com. Until next time, thank you so much for listening. Let's make it through this together.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
I'm Doug McVeigh, host of Free Culture Radio. Every month, we bring you 30 minutes of news and information about people who use drugs as we discuss topics like safe supply, safe consumption spaces, decriminalization, legalization, harm reduction,